Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast. I'm Aaron, he's Adam, and he's Julian. Julian Schoenfeld from CAPREIT. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again.
We are sitting in the office of the mayor of Mississauga. We just finished recording an episode with Carolyn Parrish to talk about some of the very progressive changes and policies that she's implemented here in the city of Mississauga, of which CAPREIT and Julian have taken well advantage of. So we will eventually talk about the development that CAPREIT is taking on here in the city of Mississauga and taking advantage of DC waivers and things of that like.
Property tax reduction.
There's all sorts of great things. And hopefully you've just listened to the episode with Carolyn, so you know what we're talking about. And if you haven't, go back and listen. Before we do that, we had Julian on about 16 months ago-ish, and we talked about CAPREIT being very active in the marketplace, being one of the largest buyers of apartments across the country, which they still continue to be, but there's a lot that's changed in that 16 months, Julian. So maybe just talk about what you guys are up to today.
Yeah, thanks. So we've been extremely active since we last spoke. A big part of our mission has been to simplify the balance sheet and high grade the quality of it. And so some of the stuff that we did was we sold our entire MHC portfolio.
What does that stand for?
Manufactured housing communities. So these are effectively communities of manufactured housing and called smaller secondary and tertiary markets. And so CAPREIT was the second largest owner in the country. It was a portfolio that it didn't really make sense to our core business. And we thought we could do generating better returns in our core business. So we sold that. We ran a process. It took a bit of time and a lot of effort from the team, but we sold that for $740 million. It was higher than our book value. And we brought that capital back into CAPREIT to reinvest in our share buyback, as well as new construction apartments. We also sold out of a minority non-managing interest that we had in a company in Ireland, a publicly listed company called IRES REIT. And we've also, through a number of transactions, sold the vast majority of our European Dutch multi-res portfolio through a subsidiary called E-Res. And we've also sold a bunch of the what we would call non-core legacy apartment buildings to predominantly private buyers. And through all of that selling, we've simplified the balance sheet. We've high-graded it. Redeploying that capital into new construction properties has been something that we think investors have well received. And oftentimes these buildings are more energy efficient. They certainly consume a lot less CapEx, a different regulatory profile. There's a lot of benefits to what we've been doing, but one of them is now we're much more focused. And so everyone is laser focused on the core mission being high quality Canadian apartments.
Is that the vision? I know that we last spoke, I think it was concentration urban centers, get your average age of the building a little fresher than I suppose it was. Does all of this feed that goal?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And, it gets announced in press releases with each transaction bit by bit. But when you look back, especially I'd say over the last 3 years, the movement that we've made has been incredible. And you look at where we are now versus where we were, it's a completely different company and much higher on the quality scale and simplicity scale.
Was there a moment 3 or 4 years ago, you know, the decision maker said, let's do this. I don't know how to define it, but let's upgrade. Let's just trade up. Let's get rid of all of the lower, older CapEx draining assets. Let's reposition our entire, because CAPREIT has been known for owning the 1970s buildings. Like that really was the majority of your portfolio. And I think when you came on, you talked about this last time, you were looking to buy new builds, buy the higher quality condo quality, if you will, but you still had a huge amount of sort of these legacy sort of 70s, circa 70s buildings.
It's a huge ship. And so changing direction is something that takes time. It takes a lot of effort. I'm blessed to have incredible teams. Mark Kenny, who's our CEO, who's been on the show, is a very strategic leader and wanted to move CAPREIT in a better direction. And frankly, I think that was partly what created my job here. And I've been fortunate to be able to help him on that mission.
How much more work do you have to do in that cleanup job?
Now, thankfully, we've done most or a lot of the heavy lifting. So last year, we did over $3 billion of transactions, which is quite a lot for the Canadian market. I don't think we're on track to hit $3 billion again this year. And
I think you said $700 million in 2023, if I remember the episode from last year.
Yeah, we went from $700 million to $3 billion. So it's not going to continue that trend and probably going to go closer to the 2023 number going forward, which is a good thing. But so we've done a lot of that. And we're always
Julian hasn't taken a vacation since 2023, by the way.
I will soon, though. Mark's making me, but... we've done a lot of the heavy lifting. We're going to always be active asset managers and always be looking to improve the portfolio quality and composition. But thankfully, a lot of the heavy lifting has been done and we're in a good spot.
So as part of the freshening of the portfolio, is from an age perspective, I know you've done a lot of forward sales, right? Which is the best way of reducing your average age of your building, buying brand new ones. But we're also here to talk about, you know, development today, which is brand new to the company. When that was first floated to the top of, you know, the hive mind at CAPREIT, what did you think about development, given that there's no track record?
Yeah, so development's not core to our business. It's not what we do day in and day out. Acquiring and managing apartments is really core to our business. And humbly say, I frankly think CAPREIT is the best at it in the country. But as it pertains to development, it's something we're somewhat a little less experienced than others. But once we saw the incentives that came into place that Carolyn Parrish had put in for Mississauga, they were pretty powerful. And we have a lot of excess land throughout the portfolio. And the gap between the development yield, the cap rate on our construction costs, and the actual cap rate that we could be acquiring at was very significant. And it was significant enough that it allowed us to say, this is worth us taking on this non-core risk for. If it was 10 or 20 basis points wider than what we could buy at, you know, we wouldn't bother going through all the incredible effort to do a development and the risk and everything that comes along with it. But it was such a widespread that it made sense. And a lot of that was, you know, part of the efficiencies of having a neighboring site, the free excess land we had. But a big part of it was the initiatives that Mayor Parrish had put in place. And so, you know, half of it was that the math worked really, really well because of all those factors that I mentioned in there. But the other half was the call to action. When we heard what the very aggressive and bold move that Mayor Parrish did, you know, we wanted to kind of step up to the plate and match her efforts.
Can I ask about just the decision-making to get into the development? You know, I'm sure it wasn't taken lightly, as you keep, you know, emphasizing, it's not your core competency and it won't be, but it's you're opportunistic being publicly traded. And there are examples of other REITs that have tried to get into development and then realize how challenging it is. And that acquiring that expertise to do it well and execute well is very complicated. How did you go through that exercise to say, you know what, this is the spread we need to make that jump? And was it the changes in Mississauga that really led it, or have you been searching for an opportunity for a while?
So I'll say that we think about everything all the time. Like, we look at all sorts of different ideas, but we really do try to stick to the core of our business because that's how you stay out of trouble. So it wasn't that we were necessarily looking that it had to hit this hurdle. And once we find a project that hits that hurdle, we're going to go all in on it. But in this case, we read about the changes that she made. We started talking about it and looking at some of our existing models and seeing that the impact was quite significant. Another factor is this is going to be low rise wood frame. We're not actually doing underground parking. And so I say that to say that it's a very quick timeline. So when you're making the go, no go decision, you're not that far out from when you're actually going to be doing leasing up and realizing value. When you're looking at high rise, the timeline is so much longer that your go, no go decision, you're basically making a decision to build and deliver something that into a completely different cycle, and that has a different risk profile. So I'd say the costs here were quite low. The timeline was pretty quick, and there was enough margin that I think everyone looking at this said this is a bit of a no-brainer.
So the site itself, this is 160 units.
136.
Okay, it's two sites. But even that, you know, doing half that number of units on a site, doing low-rise, there must be a fair bit of excess land. So how do you end up with a site or a property that has that much excess land on it?
It's actually pretty typical in the CAPREIT portfolio. As you mentioned earlier, a lot of these buildings were built in the 60s or 70s. And, you know, Mississauga was a very different city back then. And so you didn't need to maximize the footprint on the land. And so in a lot of cases, there's just excess land. Now, the land here is also good in the sense that it can't be used for high rise. There isn't enough setback for high rise. So it actually, like, it kind of screams out for low rise in there. like I said, in our older apartments, it's quite common to see that. The new construction's often built a lot more efficiently, trying to maximize the density on the space. But in these older ones, it's not the case. What's also really unique about this too is, not necessarily unique, but very helpful, is excavating and building parking is always a money loser, right? It's fairly expensive and the rent you get off the parking is minimal. But we've actually used that dynamic to our advantage in that we have excess underground parking built at both of these sites that we can't lease up. And, you know, we're not generating, maximizing revenues there. But here, we won't have to build that parking and we get to get
it. Leverage the existing units.
Right? And so we're actually doing that as often as we can with stuff. So we're going to build some outdoor amenities, but we're going to leverage the indoor amenities in the existing sites. We're going to share staff in between the sites. There's a lot of kind of synergy.
Operational efficiencies. Why don't we dive into... Let's do a little bit of math nerds. Let's jump into a little bit of where the dev yields, the hurdle, as you talked to, kind of worked out to. And really, I think that was driven a lot by the incentives offered by Carolyn Parish and the city of Mississauga. So maybe just talk through your exploration of what the city of Mississauga was offering and how that molded the ultimate development that you're ending up proceeding with.
Yeah, well, there was a bunch of factors that played in. I mean, we'll also say the HST no longer being a cost, that would have been quite significant as well. So between the HST, the DCs, so Mississauga, they cut the DCs in half and actually fully eliminated them on three bedrooms. They're trying to skew the development towards more family-oriented ones. The region of Peel cut them in half as well. So all of that was really what made the difference. Had that not been the case, this wouldn't have penciled out for us. And actually, the property tax, the 35% reduction, is quite significant. When we're developing, and you know, just to oversimplify it, and I'm going to state something incredibly obvious, but it has to cost less than what it's worth. And you have to be able to make some money off of it, because people don't go, I think as Carolyn mentioned on her episode, people don't go to work just for fun. They've got to make a reasonable return on it. And so the two ways to do that are to lower the costs or increase the end value. Increasing the end value is a bit of a touchy one because you don't want it impacting the affordability worse than it already is. And so one of the good ways was reducing property taxes, because that does increase the end value without, you know, harming affordability. But I'll also say a lot of the development that's been done, particularly I'll say in the GTA, has been these condos, these shoeboxes in the sky, and it's often investor driven. And these aren't really livable units. And, you know, as a guy with two young, beautiful daughters and a family, and I work with a lot of colleagues who are families, there is a shortage of family-oriented spaces. And so what Mayor Parish did in eliminating the DCs fully, specifically for three bedrooms, again, another call to action, because the three bedrooms are often the least profitable. You get the lowest rent per foot. The cost per foot is, call it roughly the same, but you get lower rents per foot, which is why it kind of skews smaller typically. The call to action there is what's leading us to actually do the currently intended to do the entire site with three and even four bedroom suites in there. And so all of those incentives brought us to the
table. So effectively eliminating DCs on the development. If you're doing all three and four bedrooms, you're not paying development charges.
On the Mississauga side, yeah. Yes. In Region of Peel, they're doing half. And so actually, to put that in numbers, our average DCs per door before this announcement would have been $90,000, and now it's closer to $27,000. And between that and saving about $60,000 in per door in HST, I mean, that was the difference that got us.
It's $120,000 a door right there, right? So what's that on? I'm trying to do math really, really quickly. It's a lot. That lowers your costs substantially.
Absolutely. It's a very significant difference, yeah. I think it pencils out to about $100 per square foot, which probably would have made the math quite a bit more challenging.
Yeah, very interesting.
Are you looking at other sites that you own in Mississauga to work with the municipality again?
Yeah, we are. You know, apart from the fact that it made the math work, we also like rewarding this great behavior, because I really do think Mississauga has been the poster child across the country. And the attitude that Mayor Parish had is what we frankly need to get out of this housing crisis and make sure that our kids are all going to be able to afford a home. So you have to pull building permits by November of 2026. So we're rushing these two ones to make sure that we get them in. For us to do more, we probably need a little bit more clarity that those incentives are going to be extended, but we would love to do more. And frankly, if another city was to come with the bold vision that Mississauga had, we would love to show them what we could potentially do in their jurisdiction as well.
Remember one of the real estate forums a while ago, you know, somebody stood up and kind of pointed out the obvious, which is pro formas work when the land is free, I guess in this case, it would be pro forma's work when the land is free and there is incentives. Is that where we're at for, you know, for rental construction, or would you proceed with the development as long as one of those criteria was true, either land is free or you had incentives?
I think in our space, because we need a little bit more of a profit margin because it's not core to our business, I think we need some version of both of those. Now, having said that, we have a lot of free land, so that I can't envision a scenario where we would ever need to buy land to execute on this type of a thing, just given how big the portfolio is. But we do need the incentive help. You know, frankly, I think, you know, the whole country needs this. And in some areas, it's gotten quite unaffordable. And many of us own our own homes, but I think many of us have children and want to, you know, see a better Canada for them, where they can kind of move out of mom and dad's house, get a good job, and kind of live the same life that we were all afforded.
Yeah, and don't need $3 million to afford a 3-bedroom in Toronto.
Yeah.
Or move to a city 2 hours away.
Yeah,
exactly. And what I really like about this is, again, I'll reemphasize how they're skewing the development more towards 3-bedroom units. And so in our case, we're bucking the trend of 500 or 600 square foot units. We're actually going just shy of 1300 square feet, and they're all going to be ground oriented units. So these are really going to be units where you could raise a family. And it's that missing middle. You know, you're either in a small condo or you have to fork out a huge fortune to,
or move 2 hours away, right? Yeah, like it's like, this is there's no middle.
So these are in very nice neighborhoods. They're very large units, and we're penciling out pretty reasonable rents based on today's rents, which we inflate obviously for when they get delivered, but we're making the math work very comfortably at $2.55 a foot based on today's rent. And so that's just a little bit over $3,000 at today's rent. But for a brand new purpose-built rental where you can't, you know, you can't just get kicked out because the owner wants to move in like you would with a condo or like an investor-owned rental property, you get all the benefits of having CAPREIT as a property manager, and it's affordable, and it could be a good stepping stone into, you know, while you're saving up to buy a house or frankly to raise your family and live in there for the long term.
$3,000 a month, and I'm doing this in my head, so don't hold me again, hold this to me, it's very rough, but $3,000 a month is equivalent to about, I'm going to say like $600,000 to $700,000 mortgage, which would get you, even if you had a couple $100,000 down payment, a $900,000 house, you can't buy a 3-bedroom $900,000.
Exactly.
Anywhere in Mississauga, anywhere in the GTA, right? So the cost of living, you can't afford 3 bedrooms in this neighborhood, right?
Not to mention property.
Yeah, and everything else that goes on with owning, right? But yeah, that's my point is, obviously, this is you've referenced the missing middle, right? Like you need double that really to buy a 3-bedroom house, and now you're offering for a much cheaper option.
And I say all of that, but it makes it sound like, oh, maybe the math doesn't work because the rents are lower, the units are bigger. But we're doing this now at north of a 6% development yield, more in the sixes for a property that we think stabilized would have a cap rate that would start with 4.
Is that with the land component removed from your
budget? Yeah, and this is land that you couldn't sever and sell anyway because it truly doesn't have any other opportunity because you couldn't build high rise. There's nothing else we could really do with that land. And all in, our costs per square foot are going to be, you know, when you take everything we're spending and dividing it by the leasable square foot, you know, we're going to be in the kind of mid to high 400s per square foot, which is, you know, frankly, I think it's impossible to buy for brand new construction product in the GTA. It's pretty.
What's the cap rate? What's the exit cap rate you guys are calculating?
On our construction costs, we're going to be in the mid sixes. That's the cap rate there. But what we think it's going to end up being worth, we're thinking in the kind of call it mid to high 4s.
And there's the gap you're talking about to incentivize you to actually build.
Yeah. It's pretty significant, right? And so, you know, we're hoping to make a pretty good return for our investors, but also contribute to the housing resolution of the housing crisis and affording kind of that missing middle product to folks that need a larger living space than what the market's currently providing. Another unique benefit that's helping our value in there is also there's a lot of synergies. So we're going to be sub-metering everything. It's going to be heated electrically, so that incentivizes more responsible usage of commodities. And also, we're not going to be using natural, or we're not expecting to be using natural gas in there, so it should be zero emission site. So utility is going to be near zero, and there's going to be no emissions. On top of that, the property tax is reduced 35%. We also get to leverage the existing high-rise beside, so we can use the staffing from there. We didn't have to build parking or extra amenities because we can use them. So we're going to get an NOI margin that we think is going to round to close to 90%. So there's just kind of synergies and incentives hitting us from every direction here that makes it work.
Since you're not a developer, you might have a lot of points of comparison on this, but I got to imagine the community response to the project being more positive than if you were building 30 stories downtown, you know, average unit size in the high 400s.
Yeah. So this is a project that's relatively new for us. We anticipate that we're going to get a positive response from the community. We're not building a huge tower in the sky. These are going to be four-story stacked townhomes that are going to look beautiful, and they're going to integrate very well into the neighborhood. So you can never call these things perfectly, but we're anticipating a positive response.
And you're likely going to get some movement internally. Like, how many 3 and 4 bedrooms do you have in the existing assets right now?
It would be the minority.
Right. So you might likely have some upscale, some people moving, saying in the 2-bedroom, looking to move into a 3-bedroom on that same site.
We think so, right? And we'd love to offer for those existing tenants to
so, yeah, first come, first serve, or the other way around. I think it almost gives them preferential treatment, right?
Exactly. So we haven't discussed how we're going to announce and provide for all of that, but we think it's something that's it's going to improve the landscaping. It's going to allow folks maybe that live in the area, that kids that want to stay nearby but couldn't afford otherwise to get the space they needed.
I'm sure most people can do the math, but if you have 2 kids, 2 bedrooms is not enough.
No.
Right? Like, it really isn't. Like, having...
There's an age where, you can't stack them up.
You can't do it. Yeah. Right? We just did the math. If you can't afford an $800,000, $900,000 mortgage, which most people can't, like, this is the solution.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We focus a lot on this development. We were sitting in the mayor's office in Mississauga, so of course this is our focus. But we've got you here, Julian. We started the podcast talking about a bunch of the mindset pivot you guys have gone through at CAPREIT, and you talked about you came on really to start executing on this, and you've sold a bunch of stuff. So you obviously are a little bit capital heavy, which is a good place to be for the chief investment officer. Aside from these types of missing middle developments, what other kind of things are you looking at? What are you seeing? Where are you deploying that capital?
It is an excellent spot for a chief investment officer to be in. Through all of the balance sheet cleaning and simplification that we've done over the last few years, we've managed to pay off a lot of our leverage, and we went from being in the low 40% debt to asset ratio range to being in the high 30% range. And so we've got a lot of unencumbered assets and liquidity, and we're looking to continue to acquire recently built apartments, AAA locations, high quality. So we're deploying capital in there. There are lots of opportunities out there. The biggest thing we contend with is there's a bit of a bid-ask spread. And so oftentimes these apartments are worth less than what it cost the builders to build them, hence the housing crisis. But so it becomes hard for them to be able to transact. And so, we look at hundreds of opportunities a year and transact on 2 handfuls of them. But the team's working very hard on those. For us, it's very attractive to be able to buy apartments for less than what it would cost to build them today without having to put any of that effort in or take any of that risk on. So we continue to be really, really active on that front. And all of it's part of the mission that I was saying earlier, to really high grade the portfolio and change CAPREIT to something that's a lot more, a lot better for investors, for staff, for residents, for everyone.
Does it frustrate you being at the forefront of this, the watching that, the math doesn't math?
I mean, for us, when we're buying, we look at a bunch of metrics, but essentially you're just present valuing the cash flows at a rate of return that makes sense for you. And I feel for a lot of the folks that we're buying off of when they say, well, I'm not making any money or I'm losing money on that. And you don't blame them for being frustrated with that, but it is what it is. We're disciplined in our underwriting, and we pay prices that make sense for us and works out for us. But I completely share their frustration, and a big part of it is all the taxes and charges and delays that are in there. Over the last few years, we've had a surge in immigration and population growth, and you'd think the invisible hand would kind of match that and add a bunch of supply. But, at the same time, the development charges and various taxes were increasing far more than inflation and making it hard to make the math work. And that's why it's particularly refreshing to see what Mississauga's done. They've heard those challenges and essentially gotten out of the way. And I think they're going to be rewarded with a lot more supply and affordable housing. But I do feel for the developers that, put many, many years in, put a very large amount of capital, a ton of time to end up with a project that didn't pencil out the way that they envisioned it.
You know, we've had interest rate tailwinds and rental appreciation tailwinds for so long. The cities have been able to increase DCs without much thought, and the industry has just plucked away. Now, obviously, we're at a tipping point. And again, just referencing what Carolyn Parish and Mississauga are doing is really what we need now. Obviously, interest rates we can't control. That is just a factor of just what's going on in, you know, macroeconomic pressures. Rental rates are a bit curious. You just mentioned the increase in immigration, so there should be some demand push. There's obviously a major supply crunch. However, we're not seeing sort of traditional supply and demand economics play itself out. Rents have actually continued to decline modestly over the last while. I've lost track of how many months in succession we've had decreasing rents, particularly in the GTA, but GVA, GTA, those are the similar stories. How do you make of that? What do you make of that? And how does CAPREIT approach just that sort of flat rental growth?
Yeah, so after many years of really, really strong rent growth, some of it's pulled back a little bit. They're still well ahead of where they were. We always underwrite conservatively. We tend to be more oriented towards inflationary versus looking at the trend of the kind of last 3 years, which was abnormal. So going forward, we're very conservative with the rental rates that we do. We tend to be closer to inflation, and it's just all factored into our underwriting, which has made it a bit harder right now, which adds to that bid-ask spread frustration, but we still find a way to make transactions work. We've got great relationships with a lot of the vendors and developers across the country. As a purchaser, we're very reliable. We don't sweat the small things or grind on waivers. And so I think in a very tough market, our strong reputation allows us almost to see almost all the product first. And we do our best in underwriting and searching for acquisitions, even a couple of years ago. But for us, it's just in how we underwrite. And we never anticipated that those rates of rental growth were going to continue indefinitely.
Do you think rental growth will come back, or does it tie to income? Like that was, we're always having this conversation as lenders. We're, you know, obviously naturally conservative. And so the conversation is, you know, new development, we've got a client showing up, they've got a 3-year development period, rents will be, you know, today times X when it leases up, and they're using sort of historical rental growth numbers or even inflation plus 5 or whatever the math is. And we're going, what, but if it's tied to income and income stays relatively flat at inflation, let's say, is that not a sort of a reasonable barometer?
Yeah, I think we've had quite a bit of supply, and especially we're here in Toronto. I'll talk to Toronto specifically, but and it's our largest market. We've had a lot of supply coming on, being the condos, the small unit ones, and that's put a little bit of pressure. Now, thankfully, our portfolio is kind of larger, older units. Our average size in Toronto is around 900 square feet, so very, very different type of product. But this wave, you know, it's still kind of coming and going to be coming in 2026, but, you know, 27 and onward is going to start tapering off. And when you look at new condo sales, they're near zero. And so, yes, we're contending with a little bit more supply now and a little bit lower immigration as we're working through the temporary residence. But once both of those factors kind of come off around the same time, you're going to have larger immigration coming in and more choked supply. And I do think that that's going to spell tighter rental conditions. So, you know, for now, it may continue to be a little bit more soft or modest in the current climate, but I can really, it's not that hard to paint out a picture that in, 18 months, 24 months, that it'll start tightening up again in a strong way. And again, talking to that development, that we also think going for lease up in called around 2028, that'll be at a time when there's not much being delivered, and all the existing supply that have been delivered will be, you know, predominantly one bedrooms. We'll be coming out with 3 and 4 bedrooms. So we think that we'll be launching into a really good environment. But back to your question, we are only underwriting 2.5% inflation from those conservative $2.55 rents until that time.
What did you apply to the expenses for inflation?
We were at 3%. So
okay, fair enough.
A little bit higher.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Yeah. Good question, Adam.
Yeah, it's hard to base a pro forma on the blue sky version. This sounds like you've got a much more reasonable copy. maybe on that note, maybe that will end it. Julian, thanks for coming back on the podcast. It's always good to talk to you. And yeah, this episode in particular, you know, very interesting.
Thanks, Julian.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
Welcome to the after show, where Aaron and I discuss the interview that took place. That was an interesting one for sure. I don't think we've ever done a back-to-back kind of co-related episode where first you heard from the mayor of Mississauga from the municipal side of incentivizing development.
But if you missed it, go back and listen to it.
Definitely do.
It'll make the interview we just did make much more sense.
Yeah. And it'll also, if you're not developing Mississauga, make you wish you were, or that at least your mayor was like the mayor of Mississauga. But yeah, getting the both sides of the equation. We do spend a lot of time talking to developers. That's nothing new. But in this case, we've got, weirdly, a first-time developer, major entity, getting their feet wet, getting development after, you know, decades of success not doing that. But these programs, I guess, were enough to kind of unlock some of the, you know, quote-unquote free land that's included on some of these sites.
I'm going to jump into a diatribe about how DC deferrals and financing have a conflict. And stay tuned, because I think it's really interesting and it needs to be addressed. But before we do that, I found it really interesting, you know, Julian discussing some of the numbers. First and foremost, all 3 and 4 bedrooms, amazing. Like, we emphasized it during the interview, just how awesome that is, that that's part of the incentive program that Mayor Parrish put together. Just fantastic. But that he's built into a 4.5 dev yield, which is 50 basis points above what he thinks he can buy something like that at, which is a 4 cap, and that is all that needs to be done to achieve to make them go forward.
I thought greedy developers needed huge, massive profits before they do anything. Is that the media?
Just a dead byline, just how okay. How skinny these margins are.
Yeah.
admittedly, they're fairly risk averse, right? Like, these, they're not taking big risk. And that's why they've not really ever entered into development, because they could never really justify the risk. And, you know, to get to this point, to build at a 4.5 yield, which is greater than the 4 cap they would have bought it at, like, we're talking thin margins here.
But 4.5 based on total cost, which would include land that essentially has no value unless you actually develop on it when it's free land. But the point being, yes, it's not some outsized profit there. And that's with incentives, of course, in place. But I mean, all that was enough to get them from red light to green light on doing something like this, from a group that I guess was historically pretty resistant to. They weren't looking for green lights. They were looking for red lights in terms of development.
Yeah. And so good on them. And it's great to see it. It is the type of product that we need. The partnership between Julie and Mayor Parrish obviously works. That's why we've had the benefit of putting them back to back with these episodes. And you hope, and it sounds like, based on just what I'm hearing from these two, that there's a lot of momentum from other developers all across Mississauga taking advantage of the incentives.
Anybody with a site in Mississauga right now is updating their underwriting to reflect some of this to see if it makes sense.
And hopefully it would appear to be true that it's going to result in a lot of 3 and 4 bedrooms. So, okay, let me do it.
Aaron, go for it.
Oh, I'm sorry. And this is, you know, so we, First National, quick background, are the largest apartment lender in the country. We do a lot of CMHC insured business, term business. We're also the largest apartment construction lender in the country. We've got over 100 projects for multiple billions of dollars of active construction loans everywhere from every corner of this great country. We are intimate with this program, let me just say that. And so we've been very pleased to see lots of municipalities like Mississauga and many mayors talking about ways for them to incent development in their cities. And we've been hearing a lot about these DC deferrals that are coming in.
Versus a DC waiver, it's worth highlighting that.
Yeah, and so this is, and again, just really quick, development charges, of course, are a tax on development and, you know, make up very chunky amounts of the budgets and have been one of the things that we've talked about at length on this program as the magic wand. If you could just get DCs off of a pro forma, immediately tens of thousands of units become viable and they get constructed. And we're seeing that, right? Where these mayors are saying, yeah, you're right. If I just somehow give some incentives by removing DCs or lowering DCs. And to be fair, Mayor Parrish is doing a DC deferral and a DC waiver, right? The DC waiver for 3 and 4 bedrooms and DC deferral for some other things that you have to achieve.
I bet it is more politically sellable to do a DC deferral as opposed to a DC waiver.
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, I'm not arguing why there are many mayors. And to be fair, a lot of developers, and we talked off air with Mayor Parrish about, and Julian, about DC deferrals and how many developers are asking for them too, because the reality is you get time value money. I don't have to put it in my budget. So I get a significant benefit. I got to pay it later. Yeah, I still got to pay it, but I'd rather pay it later than pay it now. And that, even just that little difference in the deferral of the development charges can mean programs proceed versus don't proceed. Okay, This is not a First National thing. I'm just making this very clear. This is a lending community issue. This is kind of financing just challenge across the board. We're very risk averse, right? We are taking very little return on our investments. So if I'm doing a mortgage of 85%, maybe even 90% of cost, I want to make sure I'm getting my money back at the end of the day, right? And so—
One bad loan can wipe out so many good loans.
Yeah, and like the core of lending, if you've listened to any of our sort of lending 101 episodes or what have you, it's about getting your money back, number one, right? The challenge of the DC deferrals is if that DC development charge is not paid in the future or when it's due.
Because at that point, we've already fully advanced construction. We've put the mortgage into term.
Yeah.
So everything's you're 2 years in.
Yeah, then, let's say it's a 5-year deferral because you're hearing 5 and 10 year DC deferrals being offered, which is different than a due on occupancy. So some of the, and so the mayor of Mississauga pointed out, and Mississauga's, their DC deferral program is the DCs are just deferred through construction, but are due at occupancy.
Which actually does work.
Which is fine. Yeah. Yeah. And we can work ourselves with that because at occupancy, we're now converting to a term mortgage. And if all taxes are paid, remember the DCs are taxes, we're all good. Everything's kosher. When the deferrals are a 5 or a 10 year, that's where we get into these challenges because, and Adam's alluding to, you know, we've converted to term, we've got a fixed rate, you've got cash flowing asset fully occupied. And 5 years from now, the DCs are owed. And so all of a sudden, and these are chunky, we're not talking tiny amounts. I mean, if it's a bigger project, you're talking maybe it's $5, $10, $15 million of DCs, taxes, now owed. Here's where the rubber hits the road. If those taxes are not paid on time, cities have this, what we call the super priority ability. They can register a lien on title in super priority position, meaning ahead of my first mortgage, which means all of a sudden that $15 million is owed before I get any money back if that property were to be sold or if anything had happened. And as a lender, of course, I can't take that risk that now I'm in second position. My first mortgage is no longer priority. I have to put in the money to pay that DC. So you're taking on a major risk that if for whatever reason in 5 years or 10 years when those DCs are owed, those taxes are owed, if they can't be paid by that developer, I'm now on the hook. The lender now has to make the payment because they have to keep their title clean. They have to keep their security clean. They have to make sure that they're not subordinate to other registrations on title. And that is the crux, is that they're just, if there is this DC deferral beyond the occupancy permit period, lenders really aren't comfortable with that risk and therefore won't permit it.
So meaning if you underwrote your deal to include a 5-year DC deferral, which of course has an impact on IRR. And now under this structure, you can only hold it during the construction period, call it, you know, 2-3 years, is half the benefit. If it's a 10-year deferral, you're getting a quarter of the benefit. This gift from the city ends up being greatly impaired just because of the finance structure. It doesn't play very well nice together.
Yeah. So, and we're hearing from many developers and Mayor Payer said it, that there are handfuls of developers, dozens and dozens, that are lobbying for DC deferral programs, lengthy DC deferral programs. So this is part of an awareness to anybody out there that's listening that is asking for DC deferrals. They're good for the construction period, but when beyond that construction period, DC deferrals just don't work from a financing structure perspective. And is there alternatives? Maybe they could be bonded.
DC deferral bond.
To be fair, First National has been raising this with, you know, anybody that will listen.
DC waiver is obviously the perfect solution.
But I think, again, Adam made the comment about just how DC deferrals are a little bit more, politically, appeasing because it just is just, don't worry. I'm not waiving the tax. We'll get the tax. Just get it a little bit later. And it's maybe a little bit easier from a political perspective to do that. So
this is a PSA from your local friendly lender. Is that the idea?
Please. We're really worried. We're hearing a lot of this noise. I know the city of Hamilton just started to offer DC deferrals for 5 and 10 years. And we've had some clients show up going, isn't this great? And we kind of go, oh yeah.
But Hamilton's had it for a while too, if you were cleaning up dirty sites and you couldn't fully utilize that program.
So we've had multiple times to tell those clients. And that's, luckily it's been, it's kind of a small program, you kind of go, no, sorry, you can't.
Yeah. And you'd hate to get the momentum politically to actually like have these municipalities agree to these waivers.
I'm just cringing. I just see Olivia Chow be like, this is the best day in city of Toronto history. We're waiving DCs for 10 years and everyone is hooting and hollering.
Yeah.
And it's all the lenders going, oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. At least the apartment lenders. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which right now is the housing market being built. Yeah. So there's a risk out there. That's it, I think, for the after show today. Thanks so much for listening to the end.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario License Number 10514 and 11252.